What is up, everyone, and welcome to Off the Books, where we're surfing the uncharted waters of accounting, of finance, and wherever else those waves take us. I'm Drew Dubner. I'm your host. I am not an accountant, but I like asking questions of people who are, so finance professionals can do their jobs better. And Mamma Mia, we got a show today. I'm here with Andy Buck and Ernest Nuncesion. Ernest, you want to tell the fine folks at home what you do and who you are?
Yeah, for sure. I'm the OG CIA and resident sneakerhead here at Workiva, part of our product marketing team, and happy to be on today.
And Andy?
Yeah, trying to figure out Ernest's title throughout that introduction. Technology enthusiast and amateur video game fan.
Amateur, give yourself a little more credit than that, Buck.
Well,
you can be professional.
Well, not really though. The thing is, I get bored of games after about 5 minutes. So I like the first 5 minutes of a game, and then it's very unusual that I'll carry on. So sort of a strange pattern there.
Well, I hope you can keep some sort of not have the attention span of a goldfish for the next conversation. So today we're talking about third party risks and video games, two things that don't often go together. Ernest, I was checking the news the other day and I emailed you about this, and yep. I read a story about a security breach involving Nintendo. And I say involving Nintendo because it looks like the breach didn't come from Nintendo themselves. It came from a third party that they worked with.
Mm-hmm.
So one of these vendors, this company called Broadon, who developed hardware and software for Nintendo back in like the late 90s, got hacked. And they leaked out 2 terabytes of source codes and other really detailed information for some of their older systems, the Nintendo 64 and the Wii. So Ernest, help us peek behind the curtain there. Like, what's going on in their audit and compliance teams right now? What do you think? What's going on? What are the conversations?
Yeah, let's start off setting the table here. Let's talk about what we know and what we don't. So there's not enough information in terms of how the breach happened. All we know is that it was a third party and one of their servers were hacked that led to the data leak. What we also don't know is to what extent of, you know, all the information that was compromised. Like you said, it mentioned things like source code, maybe some demonstrations, some videos, and even strategic presentations. So you might be saying, what's the harm here? It's all old stuff, right? But there's still a fundamental problem because no matter how old the information is, people can still use that source code to develop their own hardware and their own emulators, essentially potentially pirating that information and profiting off of it. And so I think the interesting thing here for me from kind of a compliance or audit perspective is that aside from being a huge Nintendo fan and geek myself, is that when we typically hear about these data breaches, it usually entails PII data or personally identifiable information, things like financial information, bank accounts, social security numbers, credit card, health data. But in this instance, the hackers went after intellectual property, right? So think of a company like Nintendo and really any organization where IP is kind of your bread and butter and that's your core competency and competitive advantage. That's a really tough pill to swallow. I think of like Coca-Cola. What were to happen if somebody hacked into, you know, their main recipe, right? Like that would be catastrophic potentially for Coca-Cola. So, you know, you compound that with the fact that Nintendo also had another hack a week before where apparently I think 160,000 user accounts were compromised. And that's where we note that PII earlier. This is not a good look for Nintendo reputationally. So I got to imagine that their teams are scrambling right now.
So you mentioned emulators there a second ago. Buck, is that something you're familiar with?
Yeah.
Non-video game folks.
Yeah. Well, something that's kind of interesting here is, this kind of source code and the age of this source code is in, I guess, what I consider a little bit of a gray zone. A lot of source code from old games has been uncovered over time. Like, a game developer sells off some old CPUs and someone buys them and suddenly they've got the full source code for Turok the Dinosaur Hunter, which is a rather obscure reference, but I think that actually is a true story.
I dig it.
So it's like there's the kind of the gray area here because you've got these thriving emulator communities and you got a whole bunch of people that would love some source code so they can make like their own version of Mario, for example, or do something interesting with it, kind of altruistic intentions for the most part. But then to Ernest's point, you've also got a lot of potentially compromising information on like how Nintendo develops products, right? They don't want all that out there. I could see Nintendo offering up little bits and pieces for fun for the sort of the emulator community, but if it's, you know, once it gets into that strategic function, that's probably not something that Nintendo wants out there. So it's, this one's kind of interesting because I'm not 100% convinced that what got released is going to be able to be profited on by someone, right, just based on the age and the platforms associated. That said, depending on the sort of the scale of it, it absolutely could be. And one quick note to Ernest's example on Coca-Cola, you know, the smart thing to do there would be to set up the new Coke formula in like an easy to find place, you know, so someone comes in, thinks they found the formula to Coca-Cola, and they get the one that was oh so wildly popular.
Set the honeypot out there.
Set the honeypot. Exactly.
Andy, help me understand. What do you think is, so Ernest helped us understand what might be going on from a audit compliance perspective. What's going on in their security teams right now? What's their IT team thinking?
Well, this one's kind of interesting because if I'm Nintendo, I'm way more worried about the account data that just got released. Yep. Because from a security perspective, I've got two things I got to worry about. I got to worry about this account data. And now I got to start thinking more about, as we interact with different vendors, what do they get access to so that, you know, tomorrow I don't suddenly have the Nintendo Switch source code out there or games for that source code out there. Like, who does have access to these things? And I think, you know, Nintendo is going to have to think about this. I think a bit like Apple thinks about, you know, new products where, you know, they're releasing a new iPhone. For years there, they were getting really good at nothing leaking and nothing being publicly available on the new phones. And, you know, that slipped a little bit, and maybe that's slightly intentional on their part just because there's a little less fanaticism. But, you know, it's going to be important for them to understand in their supply chain from a technical perspective, who has access to what kinds of, you know, code and information and, you know, the different pieces that make up their infrastructure. Cause then don't forget, like, Nintendo has a huge cloud infrastructure that's storing game data, user data, credit card data. So that's one component of it, but also in their ecosystem, who is, you know, who's downstream from them, who's helping them develop games, what do third-party game developers get access to, what do, you know, third-party hardware vendors get access to? Because if anything, this is pretty good evidence that at least the way they had been considering that isn't effective. So I think, you know, if I'm sitting on the security side of Nintendo, I'm starting to look into what my vendor relationships look like and what I need from them from a security perspective. But chiefly, I'm also, you know, I'm worried about my own house based on the account leaking.
Yeah. And Buck, you mentioned that ecosystem of all the parties that are involved with this. And I think it behooves us to talk about why the licensing model is so instrumental to Nintendo's business model, right? Nintendo isn't producing all the hardware, all the software, right? There are other companies out there like Activision and Blizzard and Electronic Arts that provide games on their platforms, but they need to get access to a certain level of that source code in order for them to develop those games,
right,
to work appropriately with that. And so that's why I think third-party risk management for a company like Nintendo needs to be paramount and on top of kind of their risk assessment radar.
Yeah, I mean, aside from Nintendo's primary business strategy being reselling games they've been making for 30 years, launching highly gimmicky consoles, like their most recent Nintendo console is like the first non-gimmicky console they've released in a decade. It's this thing called the Switch, and its gimmick is it's actually functional and useful because you can use it as a portable and you can use it on your television. So outside of Nintendo's sort of interesting business strategy and total lack of ability to keep up on supply chain and, you know, being out of everything all the time, they've got to look at this ecosystem and they got to think about, you know, if I supply third-party vendors with, too much information, that might compromise this. If I supply them with too little information, they might not have what they need to make a really compelling game. And I think that there's probably a balance that they have to walk there. You know, typically the way these game console development, arrangements work, at least from a technical perspective, is they actually supply a piece of physical hardware to the game developers that is either a native version of that console that can run, you know, code that they're developing, or it's a sort of a software equivalent that's able to run that on existing hardware. And so, you know, is that the kind of thing that could be easily reverse engineered or opened up? And, What are my vendors and what is my inside of my full ecosystem, hardware and software? What are they considering? What are they, what are their concerns? And I don't know, I'd actually be really curious, Ernest, your perspective as from the audit side, you look at risk all the time and you have to look at risk in really complicated ways. So if you think about like a large supply chain that is based in hardware and intellectual property, I mean, arguably intellectual property on hardware and software side, and you have all these different relationships and you're trying to create a really compelling product with, kind of creative minds and creative companies, what do you need to look out for, on the risk side?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, right? I mean, you're essentially talking about third-party risk management processes and practices. And so I think for something like this, and just talking about data breaches in general, it's not a matter of if your organization is going to get hacked, but a matter of when. And it might not be you directly, but it could be part of that value stream, that supply chain that we talked about. And so in my mind, there's kind of five areas when it comes to that third-party risk management process. First is the planning. So once you've identified, hey, here's a potential product or a service that I want to outsource to a third party, what's the plan to manage that relationship? And so you start by identifying, what's the inherent risk profile of that company? You might look at them and check them against like a blacklisted database that the government provides or whatever, right? I mean, looking at the financial stability of the company, there's a huge like risk assessment questionnaire that goes on, especially when you think about these strategic partnerships where you have to rely and have a certain level of trust with that intellectual property, right? And so that's kind of the planning phase. The second phase is due diligence. So before you execute any contract, what are you doing to review those third parties and ensure their qualifications are appropriate and understanding the controls that they have within their environment to mitigate those inherent risks that you identified in the planning phase, right? And those risks that are going to be posed by the relationship. And so one thing that a lot of companies take advantage of are the SOC 2 reports or Service and Organization Controls report, right? This provides an efficient and effective solution to facilitating what for many companies is a burdensome and very complicated third-party management process. And so that can help actually reduce costs associated with accommodating multiple questionnaires, multiple vendors. I mean, so many different vendors on that. And then even kind of the on-site assessment procedures, what I love about the SOC 2 reports is that they are audited by a third party on an annual basis. So the company is going to provide the SOC 2 report to their suppliers, to their customers, to whoever wants it, and know that you have kind of that third-party validation through a public accounting firm. The third piece is around the actual contract itself. And here's where you have to delineate the roles and responsibilities of the relationship. Who's going to do what? What access do you get to? Including contract clauses that help ensure the contract's enforceability, limiting your company's liability, kind of the indemnification that comes with it, and mitigating disputes about the performance. And so one thing that I've done in the past, when I looked at contracts in my previous life, typically you would include a provision that's called a right to audit clause. And so that gives you the right to either audit part of their operation, maybe get into their IT security, or even looking at their financials. The problem is a lot of companies don't act on that provision, especially for their higher risk vendors. Like it is, in my opinion, it's a standard term and condition that is within any contract template out there. You can go on Google and download one, and I guarantee there's going to be a right to audit clause in there, but people don't use it. And so, I mean, and again, you can make the argument, oh, I don't have time to, go and do that third party audit to hundreds of different vendors. But again, that's where you can rely back on the SOC 2 and maybe just pick the higher risk vendors that are out there. So that's the third piece. The fourth piece.
Let's jump to that fourth piece after the commercial here.
All right, sounds good.
About that. This episode of Off the Books is brought to you by Workiva. Do you remember 1985? I do not, as I was not alive, dear listener. It was a year of new Coke and hair metal. It was also the year the original Super Mario Brothers came out, and it was the year that Microsoft Excel was released. Video games have evolved really, really dramatically since 1985, and so has business, but Excel is roughly the same. Maybe you are mentally connecting dots here. My point is this. Why are you still using software from 1985 for businesses staffed and created by people born after that? It just don't make sense. Introducing Workiva. With a familiar interface, it feels like Excel, but is so much more. Centralize all your vital reporting and risk data in one spot and get rid of those terrible shared drives. This gives you more time to do important stuff, like drink new Coke and play video games and listen to Motley Crue. Yes, Workiva, it is the real thing. That's workiva.com/podcast. So, Ernest, before we had the commercial, you had a fourth thing. I totally cut you off. Please continue.
Yep, two more, I promise.
Two more,
and we'll be good here. So the fourth area is around monitoring. So after the execution of the actual contract, you know, ongoing monitoring should include both kind of the risk and performance management of the relationship. So as issues are being identified, you're remediating them, you're escalating them to appropriate decision authorities within the organization. And then ultimately, you've got these contingency plans in place that need to be maintained so that you're ensuring that activities can be transitioned in-house or to another third party in the case that it leads to the fifth phase, which is the termination. So when the contract expires, the terms of the contract have been satisfied or in response to a contract default, or it might be a response to changes in the organization or third party's business strategy, you may have to resort to kind of terminating that contract. And so companies out there need to be sure that they execute against those contingency plans in order to mitigate whatever risk might arise during that termination phase.
So I don't know all the details of the situation here, but this company they were partnering with, like this happened back in like the late 90s. Maybe they don't work with this company at all anymore. Maybe this company doesn't exist. Like, what do you do in that situation?
That's really tough, right? Especially without knowing the actual terms and conditions within the contract itself. I want to say that there has to be something inherently there. If they did enter into a business relationship, and even though it may have expired, you know, I have to imagine that there were clauses in there that said, upon termination of this agreement, you will wipe out all the data that we've given you access to, right? And so who knows, Drew, right? We don't fully understand the nature of the relationship between Broadon and Nintendo. But I mean, me personally, that's what I would want in there. Buck, any thoughts?
Well, it's pretty interesting because I also wonder if, you know, in that arrangement and in how they're treating that IP, you know, there certainly should be a data retention policy of sorts to your point, right? So, you know, regardless of how this business arrangement goes, this is how you need to handle the data that is, you know, Nintendo property, essentially, that you're using and or modifying. So it would be odd to me if there isn't something like that in place.
So one thing that's interesting to me in this whole situation, and Andy, you talked about this a little while ago, but the Nintendo 64, the Wii, those all came out like more than a decade ago. And the fact that this old stuff effectively is in the crosshairs for hackers is really interesting in light that, you know, most hackers go after stuff that they can use actionably, like the credit card information, social security numbers. Does this reframe the perception of security? Are security teams just going to perpetually play whack-a-mole with all of their old stuff?
Well, here's what I think is kind of a thought exercise here. So if I'm Nintendo, what I'm going to start thinking about is like really spending time trying to figure out and identify my security needs, right? Clearly, I have not thought about this. I have two disruptions at a corporate level, you know, fairly back to back. I need to start talking to people like Ernest and others about updating different policies, different access, different training for employees or even third parties and how to handle this information. And, you know, if I'm on the technology side, I need to start thinking about what kinds of technologies or capabilities I need to give my, you know, my employees or our business partners in order to prevent this stuff from happening. You know, I think this is generally just a, if Nintendo is not very aware that they have a gap here, you know, I'd be surprised because this is, you know, when you get to two in a row, you really start, you know, you got to start looking around your organization and understanding how you can make a positive impact to reduce the possibility.
With everyone staying home, I remember checking Nintendo's stock price a while ago, and it was growing, it was growing pretty solidly despite like everything else, the economy going. How long do these sort of things tend to impact stock price?
It's hard to tell, right? I mean, it depends on the extent. I don't think there's anything in the data leak in terms of the source code and, you know, the demos and the videos from the third party that would shake any investor confidence in the company. I think the more critical one would be the compromise to their current consumer information. So those 160,000 accounts that I talked about before, I mean, I'm one of those users too. And is it going to stop me from playing the Switch? No. Right. Is it going to stop me from loving Mario and Zelda and everything that they do? No. But it does make me more aware of, all right, I got to understand, I have a username on their website. I have a username on my Switch. You know, where else is my data susceptible with Nintendo? And so in terms of the stock performance, you know, you could argue, yeah, it's taking a little bit of a dip. I think performance wise, in light of COVID right now, video game companies, streaming companies, online retailers, like those are the people, those are the companies that are raking in right now. You know, even consumer products like Clorox and whoever else makes those wipes and soap and toilet paper and, you know, paper towels or whatever, the, you know, basic necessities, all of those industries are actually, I don't want to say flourishing, but they're doing pretty damn well right now, given the environment that we're in. So hard to say what the impact of this leak will be. I think it'll be minimal. Nintendo will bounce back. But it is interesting to kind of see the volatility within the fluctuation of the shareholder value that they've had over the past few days because of it.
Yep. Time will tell. Time will tell. I think that kind of puts a cap in the conversation. Before we go, we got our question of the day. My question for both of you, you know, in my estimation, there's two types of people. You have a Zelda person and you have a Mario person. Which are you?
That's a tough question, but I got to go with Mario 100% just because of the other cross-platform games that he had, not just the, you know, the regular Mario Brothers series, but the Paper Marios, the Mario Kart, you know, he's in sports games against Sonic. I think that Mario being kind of the first character that Nintendo, you know, that's their Mickey Mouse, in my opinion. So I got to go with Mario.
It's a bit of a tricky one. The way I typically do two kinds of people is Elvis and Beatles. So right now what I'm trying to do is figure out, like, you know, how do these things link up? I'd have to say Mario too. I mean, that you referenced 1985, Dubner, when you weren't born, you know, Ernest and I were playing those games.
Right.
And, you know, Mario was that was like a revelation sitting there on the NES, you know, my friend's house. And it's so cool, right? And it's amazing to watch a character like that evolve over time. And yeah, I mean, Zelda's an incredible franchise, and I don't know, it's kind of a different beast.
Yeah, for sure.
What about
cool, you? Cool, cool. Oh man, I'm Team Zelda. Not gonna lie, I get sucked into it. Takes forever.
That's what you look for.
That's all you get.
Yeah,
I want something I get sucked into that takes forever.
I get sucked into it.
What else do you get sucked into?
Truth be told, I'm not much of a video game guy. I got, I downloaded an emulator for an N64, and I started playing Ocarina of Time and the Majora's Mask, and damn, they're just fun. That's all.
So trivia question. Trivia question for you guys.
Yeah.
Do you know how old Nintendo is as a company?
They started as like a trading card company or something in the 1800s, right?
That is correct. 131 years old.
And they still haven't figured out how to make a supply chain work.
No.
I love the fact that they just completely, you know, the people that run Nintendo, their whole game is fun. It's like, let's make a tiny modern version of our, and this would actually be a huge debate, is how you pronounce SNES or SNES. There's like a gigantic internet debate about how to properly say that. But, you know, Nintendo made that little Super Nintendo game, and it's like, okay, now it's HDMI, so I can actually plug it into my TV, and oh, it comes with a bunch of games, and it was like $40 or 50. It was a very reasonable charge, right? And they're like, how many people will want this thing? Like, I don't know, like 150. Like they like dramatically underestimate like the demand mm-hmm. that they're going to get for things and are like continuously running out of stuff. It's almost like part of the charm of the company, you know? Like it's like
everything's a limited edition.
Yeah, you don't want them to be too polished. It's like it's more fun if you don't know when you're actually going to be able to get the thing.
I think part of that though is very strategic on their end, because if you have that scarcity and rarity factor, the demand increases. Mm-hmm. So they're going after guys like me and Buck, right? And people who are nostalgic for that stuff. And so I almost look at this as an opportunity for them, you know, even with this data leak, who knows what else that can come up with. I'm clamoring for an N64 mini. I want to be able to play GoldenEye.
Yeah. Yes.
I want those classics on HDMI on my big screen.
Yeah. A few friends and I took a couple of days and just kind of like hung out at my cabin, and we were like, it's like middle of winter. So we're like cooking and like wandering around and exploring the woods, and they're all video game guys. So they brought all these like interesting consoles and console derivatives and stuff. And we ended up playing GoldenEye for people on like a not expensive, but like pretty big LCD TV. Like yeah. I think it's like 60, 65 inch or something. And I'm not sure if my vision was way better when we played these things in high school, or if like my expectations were lower. Cause like, okay, we've got, you know, way bigger TV than we had back in the day, and I can barely see them. Like I, you know, it's like my friend is represented by like 7 blurry pixels. And back in the day, it was like, oh, there's Sam. Like let's go get him, right? But now the graphics have changed so much, and I'd love to see whether it's you know, emulation or just true updates to some of those old classics. It'd be nice to see more of that.
Well, like Ernest, you mentioned you have a old tube TV. Yep. For that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's like a sought after thing. Like you have your 64 and you play Smash Brothers on a tube TV, because there's like a different pixel rate or a different frame rate sort of thing.
Yep, the refresh rate on the CRT monitor is all that the console can happen, because the refresh rates are so much faster on high def TV. I mean, even just flat screen TVs. You could still plug in. If you have the right component cables or RCA cables, you can still plug in an old N64 into a new TV, but it's going to look like shit.
Yeah. Mm. And plus it's not the Authentico experience. Like you need like warm soda, whatever sort of snacks you're able to find at your friend's house. Like a crappy small TV that has like the green spot in one of the corners, cause like someone put a magnet too close to it. Yeah. These are all part of the,
we've successful experience. Learned it the hard way. Good shit.
Good shit. That was fun. Well, that's the end of our show. I'm Drew Dubner. This has been an episode of Off the Books. Please subscribe, leave a review, write a poem about us, tell your buddies if you like the show. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.